Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impoga. This evening, we'll talk about the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on Africa. And with us tonight is my colleague, Vincent Macquarie, managing editor of VOA's Africa 54. Vincent, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a delight.
And joining us from Nairobi, Kenya, is Nelly Mora Nyangorora. She's a Kenyan journalist. She's joining us by phone from Nairobi. Good evening, Nelly.
Good evening, and thank you for hosting me.
You're very much welcome. As I said, tonight we're talking about COVID-19 and Africa. Coronavirus disease has spread rapidly and extensively to most countries in the world, resulting in considerable mortality in Europe and the U.S., as well as in numerous upper-middle-income countries in South America and Asia. Experts predicted millions of COVID-19 deaths in Africa because many countries in the continent rank poorly on the United Nations Development Programme Human Development Index. However, several months down the road, after the first cases in Africa were detected, prevalence and mortality are still low. It remains unclear if Africa is really spared from substantial cases of death and deaths. So, Vincent, let's pick it up from there. There were dire predictions as to what would happen in Africa if COVID-19 got there. It doesn't seem to be the case right now.
Well, I think many of those who predicted what would happen in the coming month are dumbfounded today because way back, sometime in April, March, the focus was that Africa could have up to 300,000 people dead. That is just sub-Saharan Africa. And that things would be so bad in most of the countries, perhaps except South Africa, which has a more sophisticated health system. Now, that has been the opposite. Fewer deaths compared to what's happening in the Western nations and also even on the continent of Africa. In fact, South Africa has done worse than a great number of African countries that are poor. So it has been enigmatic at best. And the fact is that up to this point, there's no indication that things are getting that bad, given that, the world is where it is today. In some places, things are looking much better than they were a few months ago. So it is a rather confusing situation, but very comforting for most of the Africans, because indeed, many African nations did not have the capacity to handle such massive cases. And also the wherewithal to kind of put together what was needed in order to prevent this rapid infections across the continent.
I see. Nelly, you're down in Nairobi. How is the situation? First of all, how is the situation like in Kenya as far as COVID-19 is concerned?
We are recording over 30,000 numbers. In fact, in today's release, we had a record of 37,707 so far were confirmed cases, with the 218 new cases posted today. And that is from a sample size of about 5,420. So we are seeing the government indicating that from the past figures, we can say that the curve is flattening and the numbers are reducing. So when it goes to the distribution by counties, we're seeing that counties with the more urban slums are recording more numbers as compared to counties like the rural ones, where the numbers are a bit, they're kind of few. Like a country like Narok, it has only two cases, where Nairobi is recording 68, and Kisumu 19, Mombasa 21. So these are the counties that have some rise in urban slums. But the ones that are rural are recording fewer numbers. So from the press release today, we see like in Kenya, the numbers are kind of coming down, but there's still that curve that shows that many of the cases reported are mostly in the urban areas.
I see. Vincent, according to Nelly's figures there, it's even in other countries, it's tougher in big cities with the big populations. But Africa has also big populations, including Nairobi, which has a very huge, huge, huge place where that place, you know.
Yeah.
And cities like Abuja, like Abidjan, like Dakar. These are huge populations, people living close together, and the idea of social distancing may not even arise.
Yeah, it's actually, that was the biggest concern. This it was actually of great concern, especially in the mostly densely populated neighborhoods, informal settlements, that there was a great concern that there will be so many infections. But I think when you look at what has happened over time, you can give credit also to the citizens because they came to a realization, which is a reality that is painful, but it was so sobering, that they do not have health systems in the country that would take care of them if they fell ill. And so I'm thinking everybody tended to really take responsibility to make sure that they protect themselves and protect their neighbors. But what is confusing is how did we avoid the infections in areas where people have been unable to social distance, for example, where they live, some of them where they have to eke out a living, doing small businesses on the roadside. Just the other day, there was a massive Maasai ceremony that initiates the Morans to become elders. Those are the younger men now to become the elders in the community. And there were thousands of people just all milling together around this particular area in the Narok part of Kenya. Now, you would say typically this infection should be spreading so rapidly, but I'm thinking it's kind of something that needs to be studied and to be looked at closely. How come some of this have gone without any infections? Could it be that perhaps there's something about them, their immune system perhaps, that has exposed them to so many other forms of bacteria and viruses that have created kind of immunity to them? It is not very clear. But to the credit of the individual citizens, I saw people taking responsibility to make sure they sanitize, they wear masks where they're able to do so, they wash their hands constantly, whether they're entering a minibus or whatever the case may be. So there are too many dimensions to this, the individual effort, but also some kind of inexplicable reason why some of those people have not been infected, despite the fact that they have stuck together because of the inevitable reality of their lives.
I see. Nelly, to Vincent's point there, true, Kenya and many other African countries put in place measures that, such as travel restrictions, curfews, closed schools. Given our setup in many African cities, even rural areas where there's no social distancing, Nairobi is also a big population, what would you give credit to the people being vigilant? What do you think?
I credit these numbers, the low numbers, perhaps to what Vincent alluded to, the issue of immunity, which maybe we need to look into deeply. Because when we look at, for example, some of the informal settlements in Kenya, for instance, you find that there's actually no social distancing because it's not possible. Most people share a very small space, which even sometimes ventilation is a problem. And these spaces are very close to each other. And then there's also the issue of sharing sanitation facilities because of the setup of the places we live in. And there's also the kind of livelihood they have, because you find most of them are this small scale, who sell things close to each other. Yet numbers are not, there are no significant numbers coming from those kind of areas. So looking at the protocols and the kind of vigilance that has been put in place, and looking at the kind of lifestyle in this kind of neighborhood, we cannot really be sure how this virus is transmitted. And I think that kind of scenario has contributed mainly to the rising apathy amongst these people, because you find most of them nowadays, like in a spot check I did, you find most of them don't wear masks, because when you ask them, they say, no, this is a disease of for those people in developed countries. As we are used to our normal colds, it's 3 days, it goes. So we can manage corona. It's not a big deal to them, because, again, when they look at the numbers coming out from government in everyday briefing, they cannot identify with this number. They say, yes, we are being told thousands are affected, but you've not seen anyone around us, or any person they can identify with closely suffering from the same. So I think that there's a lot of research or study that can be done to find out how resilient is this disease when it comes to the people in the informal settlements who have no luxury of social distance or even running water to keep on washing their hands, yet the numbers have not really been that significant.
I see. Vincent, what do you make of that?
Yes.
And also further to that, the majority of coronavirus cases are associated to older people. Africa has a comparatively young population, with a median population age of about 19.7 years for the continent. So what do you make of what you just said, and even the factor of age?
Yes, what Nelia said is quite interesting, and I think it is something that needs to be looked into. But here is my other, the point I would like to make, which I think may have been the contributing factor to having low numbers in some of those areas. First, you just mentioned the age. Majority of the people in those neighborhoods, a majority of them are young people, you know, healthy people. But also, we have to consider the fact that across the globe today, it has been established that a great number of those people who get very sick and die are older, but also are people with underlying health issues. The underlying health issues include, diabetes, diseases that are very much associated with the Western lifestyle, or people who have a compromised immune system. And that is why we can have the explanation for the higher numbers in South Africa. South Africa has a huge population of people who are HIV positive, and therefore they have a weakened immune system. We saw numbers go up. So many people die, so many people get infected, and that's why they had to take some strict, really draconian measures in order to prevent massive death. So I'm thinking, in some of these neighborhoods, the younger population that does not have underlying health issues generally is resilient enough to get infected but not be affected. They may catch it. They don't get that sick. They may actually even think they're suffering from a common cold, and it goes away. And that is a contrast to what we are seeing here, even in some of the communities, say, in the United States. Those that are associated with certain health issues, you know, diabetes, the other, you know, diseases that compromise the immunity of their bodies, they have been more affected than even the poor people who may not have those kind of, sicknesses. So I'm thinking that is a factor, the age factor, and also people who do not have too many underlying health issues, especially in some of those neighborhoods where people live a simple life. They eat well, they work hard, they don't have so many of those Western type of health issues.
I see. Yes, for those just joining us, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you from Washington. Tonight, we are talking about the COVID-19 impact on the continent and how the continent is coping compared to other places. Our panelists are my colleague, Vincent Makori, Managing Editor, Africa 54, and Nelly Mora, who is a Nairobi-based independent journalist. Vincent mentioned there certain issues of age and diet, and some people have actually said Africa doesn't have a very big case of diabetes, obesity. How big a factor are those conditions there? Have they helped in the situation there?
Perhaps I can use that in relation to the numbers. When we look at South Africa and also look at Uganda, we know that those countries have in the past had to deal with these public health issues. So South Africa leveraged on their experience in dealing with HIV, AIDS, and TB when it came to corona, because they already have those kind of structures. They were quick to deploy mobile test units, and they had the infrastructure needed. When we come to Uganda, we see that even Uganda in the 90s, it had the highest number of HIV prevalence rates. And there's also been that Ebola outbreak. So using the approach they've used in the past, we see that when you look at the numbers in Uganda and South Africa in relation to COVID, the numbers are quite low because, they have an effective outreach program, both countries, and there's also that classifying district by risk level, and also the approach of science-based containment strategy using surveys to be able to deal with the disease because of leveraging on their past experiences. When it comes to Kenya, when you look at the Kenya numbers in the context of the East Africa, we only come to more numbers. And perhaps, again, it's because COVID just happened, and we have not had a strong public health response. And this, again, is informed by... can I say low trust in government? For instance, we have seen that many people choose to defy government in the sense that when they're told to wear a mask, they only do it when they see the policeman in most areas. And when they're told to keep off and keep social distance, even at the restaurant, it's on record that our Minister for Health was frustrated that some people just go to the restaurant and they still want to continue in the former lifestyle before COVID by staying in the restaurant and just ordering, pretending that they're ordering a sausage so that they can continue drinking. And there was this joke going around that the cargo sausage in that you order one sausage and you want to take so many beers. So there's the issue of approach. When you look at the underlying issues, South Africa leverage on their past experiences to tackle COVID, same as Uganda. And so the people with underlying problems, and again involving the community in intervention measures, has really helped in containing the spread of COVID in these two countries. So when it comes to, I think, underlying issues, the many cases that have been recorded, those who have the fatalities, mostly are those who have suffered those underlying issues being raised. Yes, there's TB, there's HIV, there's cancer. Diabetes is not as much, but there's still diabetes and high blood pressure, which have contributed to the rising numbers in the fatalities coming from COVID-19.
And what would you say, Nelly, to those who say maybe cases are low in Africa because the testing is low? Other countries in North America and Europe are testing more. How would you describe the testing scenario in Kenya?
In Kenya, we have had mobile test units and even at the county. You know, we have a devolved system of government, so each county has been given funds to be able to undertake mobile testing. And the response has been good. It's only that there's that propaganda that has been going on that, if you test, you'll obviously come out positive. But from the reports of the ministry, the mobile testing exercise has been successful. Through that exercise, they've managed to even carry out contact tracing, and this has been able to ensure that the COVID spread is managed. And otherwise, without the mobile testing, I think we will have been seeing rising numbers in the number of deaths and those affected.
I see. Vicent, despite all this, there have been a lot of complaints about corruption in the fight against COVID-19. Despite the corruption and, which has been widespread on the continent, we'll go back to Nelly shortly to tell us about what's happened in Kenya. Most of countries have reached the peak and seem to be, the curve is bending a little bit.
Yes. There are all sorts of speculation. It could be also the weather pattern. I think at some point the infection rates have been associated with weather changes. So when the weather changes, perhaps from cold to hot or from hot to cold. But again, it's not very clear because then in our region, like in East Africa, we're getting into the warmer part of the year. And the warmer part of the year, we suffered more during the colder part of the year. So who knows? As we get to the warmer part of the year, if truly there's some association with the weather, then perhaps we may see lower numbers if there's a factor, if that is a factor at all. But I think to a large extent, there are some unknown aspects of this, and many doctors have actually said there are still so many things that are not clear about how COVID transmits, who it really affects most, because initially, remember, in the U.S., for example, and other Western nations, older people were dying, but later we started having younger people dying, 20-something young people dying. So there are quite a number of unknowns, but on the issue of corruption, it is a very sad aspect of this when it comes to the continent of Africa. Indeed, we have now new billionaires out of the COVID money that was given from outside, unfortunately, and so many have stolen that money, enriched themselves. And as it always happens, every money that comes into the continent, for some people, is an opportunity to become instant millionaires. So that is a sad point. But despite of all that, I think many countries are doing well. It is something that is maybe unclear why, but also commendable for the actions they took. So many countries took serious measures. And I think to a large extent, citizens have taken these precautions seriously, but there are some who have become cynical, as Nelly is pointing out. Some have looked at this and thought, maybe this is not a kind of a disease, and so they don't care. But overall, I think the continent is not doing as badly.
I see. Nelly, tell us about these allegations about the misuse of theft of some COVID-19 aid in Kenya. And also, tell us what you think people have learned, or the government has learned, in as far as handling epidemics are concerned.
As regards the issue of COVID-19 and billionaires, according to a report aired by one of the leading television stations, I think the matter has been a subject of litigation, and there have been orders from the court that that story be removed from social media and from discussion. That story has fueled the continued lack of trust for government when it comes to tackling COVID-19 and promoted the cynicism because many citizens have been left feeling that perhaps this COVID-19 was not there after all. Perhaps it was a way that government used to maybe siphon out money or control the political temperatures and inflate figures so that to continue receiving some donor money. But that is an issue that we is left for another discussion. But when we look at that issue of corruption, the allegations, they have fueled that lack of trust, especially when we see in our current setup the very leaders who are expected to have been the role models and shown the example are seen mingling together in political meetings without the mask, no social distancing, and then the next thing is they're telling the citizens, you must wear a mask, you must maintain social distancing. So the political leadership has not really been the best example for many, and this has continued to fuel that lack of trust in some of this government intervention. Again, the other issue is the heavy securitization of the whole process, in the sense that the police have been left to sometimes enforce the lack of use of masks. And the results have not been good because the same government that is telling the citizens we know to maintain social distance, when they are found without the mask, they are put together, so many of them in a small police van, and they are driven around. And the allegations that come out is that they are asked to pay, to part with some money to get free. So again, the citizenry have felt this is another way for the police to get money from them. It's not about their health. It's about someone else to, trying to benefit from the supposed crisis, so to speak. So all this, plus even government, you know, remember there's the early when the COVID was intense, sometime in mid March, or rather I think early April, the government in its attempt to try to prove to people that COVID is indeed serious and it's there, tried to use a survivor of the crisis and put on TV. And the results were not very good because people started poking holes on that experience, claiming she had been state managed, and the way she expressed herself, they said there's no way you can be free from COVID and look all good. You know, she was looking all nice and everything, and her story somehow didn't add up. So all this contributed to the rising apathy, and many have felt like really. I think the government's approach in terms of the crisis communication, to me, I feel it has not really been effective. Because even when they're using the medium like radio to reach the masses, the messaging has not really been effective in trying to address the apathy towards COVID-19 in Kenya.
I see. Vincent, briefly, what's your takeaway from what Africa has handled this?
Well, I think one of the things that all African nations learned is that this kind of a pandemic has exposed the limitations of the continent. One, you need to develop better health structures, but also you need to develop a better response system to such pandemics. Another thing, it used to be that whenever, let's say, the elite get sick, they can get out, jet out to another country and get treatment. COVID-19 has taught the continent that now it's a time perhaps to consider having your countries equipped to handle anything, because nobody could go anywhere to be treated. There's no other there's no country that could offer treatment, and plus all these restrictions, people are not really allowed to go anywhere. So I think the greatest lessons are that, one, you must develop the structures in the country to help handle such a situations. And also, it's okay. It is important for every citizen to be able to access good health care, because in a situation where people can infect each other, you do not really win by having only the rich or the elite have access to good health.
I see.
Secondly, you can't rely on going to another country to get treatment. It has to happen at home.
I see. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. That wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thank you to my colleague, Vincent Macori, Managing Editor of US Africa 54, and Nelly Mora Nyangarora, a Kenyan independent journalist who joined us from Nairobi. Thanks very much for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
You're very much
Thank
welcome.
You
and we're back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thanks very much for tuning in. And until then, I'm Douglas Simpuga, wishing you all the best.
Prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week. Issues in the News moderator Shayna Estulin and a panel of experts will analyze the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.